Part 4, Chapter 3, in which Harvey rides the rails. Quote, Los cantos mejores son visiones de encanto al vuelo de un tren. Rufino Blanco Fambona, Explicación, Translation. The best songs are visions of enchantment seen from the flight of a train. The course that Harvey charted took him past all the landmarks of Part Two, Zante, Levcas, Kerkira, Messina, Naples, until his boat reached Portofino. It was evening when he arrived, and he remembered his voyage with Mahogany in Chapter One of Part Two. It had been a time of great pain, filled with the suffering of his friend, but it had also been a time of camaraderie and compassion. He thought he might be able to get back to 2013 if he returned to Mario's castle, but before he could steer his ship in, a storm rose and blew him north to Genoa. Back on the airplane. They were just passing over Scottsdale, and the captain rang for the stewardess to ask for another drink. When she arrived with his ouzo, she noticed the manuscript in his hands. "The Adventures of Captain Harvey?" she said. "Roland Twelves is my boyfriend's brother. What chapter is that?"
"Chapter 3 of Part 4," said the captain.
"Part 4," said the stewardess. "I have only seen the first chapters of Part 1. Do you think I could look at it when we reach New York?"
"I'm afraid I'm going on to Athens," said Harvey.
"Maybe I could read it during your layover in Kennedy." Harvey told her that would be fine, and she insisted on showing her gratitude by bringing him another drink. In an instant she was back with a carton of mini-bottles. They were wines and liqueurs from France and Italy and Spain.
"Bon voyage," she said.
Harvey returned to the manuscript. It was midnight when Harvey moored his ship outside of Genoa and stepped onto the shore. As much as he loved to sail, he knew that he had a better chance of finding himself on land, so he turned his back on the coast and started toward the city. The first thing he encountered was the freight yard of the Genoa train station. It was full of old cars, and he found an open one and climbed aboard to sleep.
"That calls for a nightcap," said Harvey, rattling through his collection of mini-bottles. "Let's see. How about a little something from northern Italy? Ah, yes, a schicchiatra."
Back to the manuscript. While he was asleep, Harvey's car was coupled to a train bound for Paris, and at 8 o'clock in the morning he awoke in the Gare de Lyon.
"That was quick," said the captain, guzzling his schicchiatra. "How about a Côte du Rhône for breakfast?"
Traveling alone was not easy, for without Mahogany to guide him, the captain was influenced by every person he encountered. Bouncing like a pinball from tourist to tourist, it was impossible to follow any fixed course, and though he wanted to get back to his future, he was on a horse with no reins. Fortunately, he had a 3-month Eurail pass RT had given him in Salt Lake, and that became his savior, for it assured him of a place to sleep and eliminated the need of buying tickets. But there were other consequences as well, for without the companionship of his friend, Harvey was vulnerable to all the world's anger and all its insecurities. Suddenly anyone could be dangerous, and the rudeness of a vendor, or conductor, or waiter, could cut him to the heart.
"Pauvre capitaine," said Harvey, feeling the effects of the wine, "une bouteille sur la mer, remplie par les inclinations de la chance."
Translation. Poor captain, a bottle on the sea, filled with the inclinations of chance. He returns to reading the manuscript. Harvey quickly discovered that, in order to live on the trains, he needed a backpack. Fortunately, he found one in Paris, abandoned in a second-class waiting room. Its frame was bent and broken, and it needed to be rebuilt, but all he could find in its pouches were a needle, thread, and band-aids. After several hours of ingenuity, he had put it all together, and then he tested its toughness by throwing it down some stairs. In only half the time, he managed to repair it again, and without any further tests, he adopted it as his own. The next order of business was to learn how to live on the trains, and in particular, how to get a good night's sleep. It was an art that taught itself, and in less than a week, Harvey had developed a formula for success. Footnote. The following notes, scribbled illegibly on the wrapper of a baguette, were found lining a birdcage in Besançon, France. They were brought to the United States in 1999, and are now on display in the Jackson Quintilius Museum in Leucadia, California. Back to the text and his formula for success. The notes. Sleeping on trains. The key to sleeping on a train is securing an empty compartment and keeping others out. This may be accomplished by observing the following steps. Number 1. Check the schedule for departures and give yourself plenty of time. Number 2. Identify your train and check its composition. A board will display the arrangement of both first and second class cars. Remember, your Eurail pass is not valid for sleeping cars. Select a car at the extreme end of the platform. Number 3. Position yourself on the platform before the train arrives. Number 4. Board quickly and find an empty compartment. Number 5. Check the window for reservations. Number 6. Close the door. Number 7. Turn off the light. Number 8. Pull the curtains. Number 9. Empty your pack on the seats. Number 10. Dangle your socks from the luggage rack. Number 11. Throw your pants in front of the door. Number 12. Have gas. Remember, your compartment is your castle. Whoever you let into it, you let into yourself. Of course, some cars had bus seating instead of compartments. On those trains, sleeping was out of the question, for the seats and the aisle would be filled with student travelers draped in every shape of contorted collapse, all of whom would become the unwilling spectators of the parade to the WC. The scene was always the same. The door to the car would be opened, and a person would survey the aisle, plotting how to avoid the humanity sprawling on the floor. Then they would begin, cautiously at first, but kicking an arm or a leg and apologizing to each person they woke. And they would continue to apologize until they were halfway down the aisle when, losing their patience, they would stomp through the rest of the car. There would be a short pause as the sleepers settled back to their places, and as soon as they were settled, the person would return and repeat the journey in reverse. There was always someone sleeping in the middle of the car who was kicked again and again and again. Even on a train with compartments, it was an adventure to make a night trip to the bathroom. There were the first tenuous steps as you slipped into the corridor, and the general disorientation and stiffness of limbs, and then when you opened the door at the end of the hall, whoom, you were hit with a furnace of noise. You would have to brace yourself so as not to be thrown when you crossed the coupling, and then it would be quiet again as you entered the next car, until you were hit with another blast of noise when you stepped into the WC. Then it was only a matter of lowering yourself onto the moving target before you could pause to meditate on the nature of your business. And the flush would give you another blast before you began the trip back. "Come to think of it," said Harvey on the airplane, "I need to go to the bathroom myself." He got up from his seat and went to the back of the plane. Ah, he thought, saying goodbye to 3 bottles of wine. When he returned, he continued reading. Travel by day was quite different, for the compartment was open and everyone was invited in. Harvey's favorite trips ran along the coast of the Mediterranean. They were particularly interesting for the variety of languages that were spoken as the train passed from country to country. On one trip from Marseille to Rome, Harvey spoke Spanish, French, Italian, English, and Greek. The first person he talked with was a nun from Spain. She was on her way to see the Pope before he departed on his world tour, and she was nervous after a sleepless night on the train.
She had not learned Harvey's system for securing an empty compartment, and had been interrupted several times. Although the captain had slept well on his trip from Paris to Marseille, he became agitated with the anxiety of his friend, and began to imitate her as she said her morning rosary. His prayers were finally answered when the nun left for the W.C. and they passed Cannes, and her seat was taken by a young French girl. The girl was dressed in a black skirt and blouse, with black stockings and a blue scarf, and Harvey couldn't tell if she was 13 or 23. Without looking at our hero, she sat down and crossed her legs, and when she opened the book she was carrying, the captain read along with her. Elle était donc couchée, et se laissait aimer, et du haut du divan, elle souriait d'aise, à mon amour profond et doux comme la mer. Translation, Charles Baudelaire Les Bijoux. She was lying down, and she let herself be loved, and from the bed's height she smiled for pleasure at my passion, deep and gentle as the sea. Arrgh! Growled Harvey, pretending to look out the window. Sur la mer ou non sur la mer? Les yeux fixés sur moi, she continued to read, comme un tigre dompté, d'un air vague et revers, elle essayait des poses, et la candeur unie à la lubricité donnait un charme neuf à ses métamorphoses. Again, Baudelaire, translation. Her eyes fixed on me like a tame tiger, with a vague, dreamy air. She tried various positions, and ingeniousness joined with slipperiness gave a new charm to her metamorphoses. She looked up at Harvey and uncrossed her legs, then returned to her reading. Harvey reached into his pocket for a Greek figurine and began to caress its extremities. Et son bras, et sa jambe, et sa cuisse, et ses reins, poli comme de l'huile, onduleux comme un cygne, passé devant mes yeux clairvoyant et serein. Translation. And her arm, and her leg, and her thigh, and her loins, polished as with oil, sinuous as a swan, passed before my calm, clear-sighted eyes. Harvey dropped the figurine on the floor, and the girl bent to pick it up, tossing her long hair across his knees. Then she took it in her hand, and was about to put it in her mouth, when the nun returned to the compartment and let out a scream. When the train stopped at the border crossing in Ventimiglia, people left their compartments to look out the windows of the corridor. Harvey joined them and met a couple from Stockton, California, who were comparing Italian wines. "I think our wines are just as good as theirs," said the woman, uncorking a bottle of Suave Bolla. "This one tastes a little like a Gallo Chardonnay," said the man, pouring the captain a glass. The testing went on until they had finished the two bottles they had, and Harvey, feeling fine, returned to his compartment. The French girl was gone, and an elderly Italian gentleman had taken her place. He lived in San Remo, where he had opened a bakery called the D'Angelo Pasticceria. He had a great love for fishing, and was full of advice for our open-minded hero. Vento levante, pesce distante. Vento oriente, pesce presente, he said. Translation. Wind to the west, fish are distant. Wind to the east, fish are present. As the train passed through the tunnels of the coast, he went on to tell Harvey the history of the short and stocky people known as Ligurians. Eventually, he came to the history of his own family, and he mentioned that his daughter was in the wine business. Tanti anni fa, si è sposata con uno dei fratelli Gallo, e le ha portato tutti i segreti italiani. Translation. Many years ago, she married one of the Gallo brothers, and she gave them all the Italian wine secrets. When it was time for lunch, the man reached into a paper bag and pulled out a multi-digited loaf of bread that looked like a fat-fingered hand. He tore off a finger and handed it to Harvey. Pane Picasso, he said, putting a thumb in his mouth. Lo fanno a Valoris.
Picasso, echoed Harvey, reminded of mahogany and their time in the museum in Antibes. When they reached Pisa, the man left to change trains, and Harvey got up to stretch his legs. While he was standing in the aisle, he overheard a conversation in a neighboring compartment. A young Danish woman was talking with a college student from Massachusetts, explaining her experience as a traveler. "It has been very interesting," she said, "because no one I meet knows who I am."
"So?" said the American.
"So each one of them," said the Danish woman, "comes up with their own idea of me. And their ideas are always different. I'm a thousand different people, depending on who I'm talking to."
"Just because they think you're someone else," said the American, "doesn't mean you are."
"Doesn't it?" she said. "I mean, I can't help but be influenced, if only a little, by what different people think I am. And if they think different things, then I am different with every one of them. The same thing even happens with people who do know me. Actually," she continued, "I think that's why a lot of people don't travel. It's frightening to leave your home and everyone that knows you, to go abroad where you have no history. It's hard to give up the foundation that tells you who you are and face the fact that your only true being is in the present. All the objects you have at home, the things you have worked to purchase, the things that carry the mark of your name, your brothers, sisters, parents, and children, are meaningless. You are naked when you travel without them. You have only your own personality to show, and many people are afraid that without all those trappings, they might not really be anyone at all." "Of course," the woman continued, "if you get past the fear, you can be liberated by travel. You can see that the people who know you and make up your past are often the chains that keep you from growing. They keep you from finding out who you really are by reminding you of who they think you are." "It was only when I was without my history," she continued, "when I finally let go, that I began to see my possibilities. And once I saw them, I could explore them, and then I could decide who I wanted to be. Most people live their entire lives determined by what others think they should be."
"Not me," said the American. "I don't care what anybody thinks."
When Harvey returned to his compartment, a Greek family had taken all the seats. They had been visiting relatives in La Spezia and were beginning the trip home. When they realized they had taken the captain's place, one of the daughters got up and moved into the aisle. Though Harvey protested, the young woman insisted on standing for the rest of the journey, and the captain was glad of it, for it gave him an opportunity to admire her slender form that was revealed by the wind flapping in her dress.
"Ah, Alessandra," thought Harvey on the airplane, remembering how she had looked the last time he saw her, pure and innocent, with the wind in her tunic.
And so it was that Harvey traveled. Venice to Nice, Munich to Paris, Oslo to Stockholm, Salzburg to Rome, and even if he repeated the same trip, it was as varied as the different personalities with which he traveled. On one trip, he would see with the eyes of a Belgian shopkeeper. On another, the eyes of an Italian banker. On another, the eyes of a priest, or a poet, or a student, or an assassin. Only occasionally was he drawn into a town, for as soon as he was on the steps of the station, the crowd rushing in would carry him back to the trains. After 40 consecutive nights riding the rails, Harvey found himself headed south. He was weak and feverish from so much travel, and when the train made a midnight stop at the border town of Cerbère, he staggered into the waiting room and collapsed on a bench. A blustering wind roared through the station and hammered on the doors, and despite his infinite fatigue, Harvey was unable to sleep. The pilot announced they would soon be landing in New York, so the captain closed the manuscript and fastened his seat belt. When they reached the gate, the stewardess gave him a pass to the VIP lounge and promised to meet him there. Harvey took a nap while she browsed parts 3 and 4, and when it came time to go, she helped him find his connecting flight. As soon as he was settled in his new seat and the plane was rising over the Atlantic, Harvey turned to Chapter 4.